Last week, Subha Dramati introduced us to the notions or the principles of ethics as they relate to the threefold path, the path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom, as a way to start approaching how we might create the conditions for seeing through into the way things really are. And particularly introduced us to the notion of how we have a fixed, or a delusion, a root delusion of a fixed separate self, and that in itself conditions our mind and mental events, and our mind and mental events lead it to our actions in the world. And introduced us to the notion of karma, and karma as a natural law, a natural regularity, in bold speech, that we live in a moral universe, a universe where our actions have consequences both for ourselves and the world around us, and that this principle is observable in experience. So our actions have consequences. So, for example, actions that stem from states of love, kindness, generosity, stillness, simplicity, contentment, awareness, will lead to positive consequences. And actions that, born of greed, hatred, delusion, unawareness, spiritual ignorance, will lead to harmful or negative consequences, particularly in terms of the suffering we create for ourselves and the suffering we create in the world, or the positive benefit that we have for ourselves or in the world. And particularly what struck me was this notion that rather like gravity being a natural law in the world, which is observable, you know, we know that if we jumped off a cliff, we're liable to get injured. Yeah, we know we're going to go down. You know, if we jump up, we're going to come down. If we drop the apple, it's going to fall down, it's not going to go upwards. So the sort of law of gravity is observable. In this way, so is the law of karma, or willed action, observable. However, there was this very lovely idea that we sort of know instinctively about gravity. We know instinctively about gravity. We've observed it, we've seen it at work in the world. But we don't know as instinctively the law of karma. In a sense, the Subha Dramati was saying she wished she knew the law of karma as well as the law of gravity. It's an important practice to really become attuned to the principle of karma, to the principle of actions having consequences, as a way of refining and tuning our ethical and moral sensibilities, as a way of refining our mind, as a way of sensitizing our mind, so that we become more sensitized beings. And the contemplation and the commitment of acts of kindness, generosity, stillness, simplicity, contentment, truthfulness, awareness, will have an observable effect. If we engage in generous acts, we will see an effect of that. But we have to engage with it. We have to, in a sense, commit to finding out. And so, from the point of view of the spiritual life, we take on provisionally a training in ethics, in sensitizing our minds in order to derive a particular effect. And well, what happens when we submit to those principles, when we willingly practice those principles, our mind becomes more sensitive. Our mind becomes more sensitive. Our conscience, you could say, becomes clearer. Our conscience becomes clearer. And this is what where the bridge into what we're going to discuss this week starts arising. Because as our conscience becomes clearer, it is less likely to be troubled. It's less likely to be restless. It's more likely that when we sit to meditate, we will be less distracted. We will be worrying less, perhaps experiencing less anxiety through having a clearer conscience. So this week we're going to be exploring the next stage of the threefold way, the stage of samadhi, and I'm going to try and keep the Buddhist jargon to a minimum, but I am going to use some. So first explanation: samadhi, meaning meditative concentration or meditative absorption. In a certain way, concentration can lead us to a wrong conclusion about the nature of samadhi. Because it's not concentration in the terms of a willed effort. It's not the sort of forcible holding of the mind on an object, say the breath. But more, I like to think of concentration as something becoming more essential, something becoming more distilled, more of its own nature. So like you, in a way, would distill alcohol. Probably not a great metaphor. But you see what I mean. Something becoming much more pure. Yeah. When we're thinking of meditative concentration, what we're doing, at least from the point of view of samadhi, is making something more awareness, more pure, more essential, more still, more its own nature. So we can think about concentration in that sense when we're thinking about meditative concentration, or you could say meditative absorption. So we'll be explaining, or at least exploring, how we move from our worldly mind into a mind more suffused with reality. In the second half. So, but first we'll have a cup of tea. So we come this week to the second stage of the threefold path, the stage of samadhi, or meditative concentration, and particularly looking at the way in this threefold definition of having a fixed self-view, which conditions our mind and mental events, which then conditions our actions in the world. And you could say we work on our actions in the world through ethics, but it's our mind and mental events which is the domain of samadhi, or meditative concentration, meditative absorption. Well, samadhi appears not only in this list of ethics, meditation and wisdom, but it's also the culmination, the last limb, as it were, in the Noble Eightfold Path, samyak samadhi, perfect meditative absorption. And so hopefully over the course of this next hour, we'll move from accessing concentration, as it were, accessing this absorbed meditative absorption through what happens when we sort of refine our mind into contemplation of reality. So that's quite a long journey in an hour, but we'll see how we get on. I thought I might, as sort of subheading for tonight, of everything you were wanted to ask about meditation but were afraid to ask. Because it's not very often we get a chance to talk about meditative practice, or at least working with meditation. And, well, if there are questions that come up at various points about working in meditation, well, just ask. If I can work an answer in, and it's sort of on topic, as it were, then I will. So looking at that, the breadth, as it were, from samadhi as meditative absorption to samadhi as the direct apprehension of reality in our experience. Well, there's a doctrinal precedent for that range, and it's in the Platform Sutra, the Sutra of Huineng, and it's one of Zen's great contributions to the meditative life of Buddhism, whereby there's a whole range of experience of meditation that's referred to by Huineng, where samadhi is not only defined as meditative absorption, but it's also the absorption of the whole being in reality. So it's the state of mind and the state of consciousness in this state of the whole embodied being suffused and absorbed with reality. So in a sense, what I'm saying is meditation takes us all the way. It's a practice which is for the whole of the path. There is no point in the path of Buddhism, of the spiritual life, of our development, that doesn't include meditation. The Buddha was meditating, doing the mindfulness of breathing, when he gained enlightenment. Yeah? The meditation we've just done is the meditation the Buddha was doing at the point he gained enlightenment. Okay, so how do we move? How do we move from absorption to an apprehension of the way things really are, the apprehension of reality? How do we see, for example, impermanence, insubstantiality, and unsatisfactoriness directly in our experience? So let's start. I'm going to introduce two more terms. And I promise to try and not do any more. So firstly, the first new term that goes with samadhi is shamatha. And shamatha literally means calming down, okay? So there are practices that we do, such as the mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana, which are shamatha practices. They're practices which help us integrate, that help us calm down, and help us to be with experience more fully, to be more alive to the experience that we're having, to stay with that experience. So they help us develop not only to integrate our energy, our thoughts, into one purposeful stream of consciousness, yeah, but they also help us to develop a continuity of awareness. They help us to stay with what's ever happening in our experience. Okay, so shamatha practices, the mindfulness of breathing, the metta bhavana, are practices that help us to become more concentrated. So you could say the mindfulness of breathing, and this is sort of elementary, because if you've done an introductory course, you'll have heard this, but actually you might not hear it again, so I'm going to repeat it. So the mindfulness of breathing is a practice which helps us integrate our diverse energy. In the break, Maitreya Bandhu was talking about how scattered our minds are, how distracted, how we have a tendency to dribble away our lives in distraction, distracted from distraction by distraction. And so, most of us probably have a fairly real experience of that. I certainly do. When I was checking in this evening, I had a sort of confessional element that I'd enjoyed the series 3 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and but actually it was just a distraction, as it were. I have a weakness for American teenage rites of passage sort of movies. It is a particular weakness of mine. Such good scripts, though. Anyway. So, but we can fill up our lives with these things that sort of we enjoy, but they don't particularly enrich. They don't particularly lead to us having a more concentrated, more present, more alive, more vivid experience of ourselves. In a certain way, they take us out of ourselves. They take us away from ourselves. Or they at least allow us to inhabit a certain part of ourselves, the certain part which is about enjoyment and pleasure. And we certainly, most of us, have a bias towards that, in whatever way we might find to distract ourselves with pleasure. It might not be Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but it could be something else more worthy. I'm sure it is. So essentially, what we're trying to achieve with shamatha practice, with the mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana, so the mindfulness of breathing, we're trying to integrate our energies, trying to become more purposeful, through practicing ethics and through meditating, to develop our sensitivity of mind, so that we have... we practice ethics outside of meditation so that in meditation we can make wise choices about what we want to give our attention to in the context of meditation. I don't think it was last week, but I was recently on a retreat where somebody mentioned the last words of the Buddha, Appramadena Sampadeta, with mindfulness, strive on. And the word Appramadeta, is from Appramada, which means heedfulness. And it's a particular meditative quality which can arise through practicing the mindfulness of breathing. This sense of what we want to give our attention to. We can develop our intuitive sense of, I feel I'm getting involved in a conversation or a distraction. Well, I just want to... That won't lead me anywhere helpful. Yeah? So, or I can feel restlessness. If I engage with that, then it's going to take me out into distraction again. So we can make sort of wise choices in meditation as we develop this sense of heedfulness in meditation. Yeah.
Aren't we supposed to stay with the breathing? I mean, even if we thought of the most... edifying idea we ever had in our lives, should we say, blow that, I'm staying with the breath?
Well, that's an interesting point, and I'll come back to that in the next stage, okay? The other word that I'll introduce in a short while, because sometimes we can have real clarity about things in meditation because we've stilled and quietened and become more creative and spontaneous in the context of the practice. And it's a particular reflection of the refinement of our mind sometimes. And so, yes, sometimes there's the need to think, okay, so that's really interesting and exciting and I've not had that level of clarity before. I'm just going to put that aside until after I finish the practice. Yeah? However, if something has a particularly strong emotional component and we're very much activated in an emotional sense behind it, then sometimes it's necessary to give some reflection time and then come back to the practice. So does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'll say a bit more about that in a bit. So as well as calming down, as well as developing heedfulness and a continuity of awareness, the ability to stay with our experience, to notice what's happening and stay with our experience, is what we're trying to do in the metta bhavana and mindfulness of breathing. The sort of qualities that might arise in meditative experience. So we're integrating our energies, we're becoming more, in a sense, more absorbed, more distilled, or at least that's what's happening when meditation has got its own life. You could say shamatha practices also cultivate tranquility and peacefulness. Okay? I think this is particularly a quality of the metta bhavana. As the mindfulness of breathing integrates and gives us a sense of clarity and purpose, so the metta bhavana can balance our perspective. It can give us the balanced perspective. It can give us that warm, kindly, gentle response to whatever arises. So it can be that we have mindfulness can lead us into a particularly cool awareness, a sort of analytical, cool, even remote awareness, if it's not suffused with metta, if it's not suffused with kindness, gentleness, interest, which are particularly metaful qualities. So what I'm leading us to here is that mindfulness and metta practice are both two sides of the same coin. So you could say mindfulness, the spirit of mindfulness is metta. The spirit of mindfulness is metta. So we want our mindfulness, our attention, our absorption to be suffused with this sense of warmth and kindly engagement, a patient forbearance, and that allow us to be with our experience in a creative, kindly, spontaneous, responsive way. Yeah. So we simply are patient with ourselves and with experience. So metta being the spirit of mindfulness. And you could say, and this is the purist will challenge me on this, that metta is a mindfulness of others. Yes? So we are mindful of others. We develop our ability to hold people in mind, to stay with them, to be for them. Yes? Just to be with them in mind, holding people in mind. And so the person in each set of the metta practice is the object that we're with. Yeah? And we stay with them. In a way that, in practicing metta, that's all we have to do. That's all we have to do. We just have to keep being with, keep engaging with, keep that person vivid, with a sense of just being for them, for their welfare, for kindness, for the development of, for their own development, on their own terms. So there is one more thing that I'd like to cover in this section. But before I do that, I just wondered whether there are any questions, challenges, issues, claims or concerns. Does that make sense? So this is sort of meditation 101, isn't it? You probably all have a sense of that. Is this all sort of fundamental to meditative practice, but it's good revisiting because I think what I'm talking about is principial rather than about technique. Yeah, and it's good when we're practicing meditation to be really clear about the principles of meditating or concentrated awareness. So we're noticing what's happening in our experience and we're staying with it, okay? So, so the other thing that often hijacks or undermines our ability to develop a real vivid sense of our experience is having an expectation of the type of experience we want. Okay? In a way, what we can do is we can jump over our experience from the experience we're having into an experience we're not having but would like very much. Thank you very much. So we might have an expectation that meditation should deliver calm, or meditation should deliver, you know, some sort of tyranny of should. Meditation should be enjoyable. Meditation should not have any pain attached to it. Meditation should be without restlessness. Meditation should, I should be able to get concentrated. You can add any sort of expectation onto a should that you like. Okay? So in that sense, what we're doing is we're overlaying our experience with something that we'd like, yeah, or that we have a view that meditation should deliver. Okay? The only thing that's going to happen there is we're not going to get what we expect, because life isn't like that and our mind isn't like that. And we're likely to be disappointed. More often than not, it'll lead us to a view that we're no good at meditation, it doesn't work for us, because I can't concentrate for toffee, so therefore I'm no good at meditating. Because I always get terribly distracted or busy or restless, so therefore I'm no good at meditating. And whenever we engage in thoughts like that, what we're doing is we're simply engaging with an expectation that meditation should be or should deliver something. So I'd like to invite us, as a principle of meditating, to not do that, and to engage with a sense of intentions. So holding a broad intention at the beginning of a meditative practice, for example, be alive to experience, or to just be with whatever arises, yeah, and to just notice and stay with the experience that's arising. So if we're staying with an intention, we're engaging with a process. Yeah? We're attending to the process that's unfolding, rather than an expectation of a particular result. Yeah. So how would that look in the context of a practice? So if we stayed with an intention to be alive to the breath, it would mean that we could take a sense of exploration, a sense of discovery into the practice, and we wouldn't have any sense of what it should be like. We can just quite freely engage with the actual experience with a gentle, patient momentum of keeping coming back. So if it were a question, it would be, what's happening now? If it had a question attached to it, it would be, what's happening now? Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Does that raise any questions? So engaging with an intention allows us to attend to...
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. So we can use any sound at any time that arises to become more alive to what's happening in the moment, yeah? So whenever anybody walks into the room or whatever, we can become more alive, yeah, more aware to whatever is happening. Okay. So we're engaging with this sense of intention, this sense of we're attending to a process, we're engaging with discovery. If we can stay with experience, stay with the qualities of the breath, yeah, and get interested in the qualities of the breath, in the mindfulness of breathing, look at what's the breath doing, where is it in the body, where is it a long or a short breath? Is it rough or is it smooth? Is it wide or is it narrow? Where do I experience it? Is it just in the belly? Is my whole body breathing? You know, what's happening? Where is it living? Where am I alive? Yeah.
Those feel like lots of questions, which I get a sense I'm going to go into a chattering mind. Because I tend to coach myself through anxiety. I want to stay with it, but I find that my mind is chattering to kind of coach my way through staying with it.
So these are suggestions for engaging with experience rather than suggestions for questions that we actually ask ourselves. So that sort of lead,
into
the direct experience.
Yeah.
So we're engaging with the felt sense and the movement and dynamics of the breath as experienced directly in the body. Yeah.
See, you're talking about movement of the breath and sensation. There is movement, but also there's sensation. And when you take us through the body thing at the beginning, you talk about the contact with the body to the mat, for example. And you're talking about two things, contact and sensation. I'm not even aware of sensation. I can feel, my foot isn't in midair, it's touching that. I can feel the movement of the breath, but I'm not sure if I've got the sensation. I'm just aware of the movement, because that's bigger.
So there are feelings that come with movement, aren't there? There might be a sense of warmth, there might be the contact with our clothes and the sensations that arise from that particular movement. In a way, it just is something that we need to test and taste over time. As our awareness develops, so does our sensitivity to different aspects of our experience. So actually, when we start, it might just be that we experience the contact. But as subtlety develops, it might be that we notice other things about that contact, that it has particular qualities, it has particular, it has heat or it has cool, it has movement, has, you know, sometimes I feel an expanding and contracting sensation as my sort of blood goes into my foot, So what I'm leading us into when I'm mentioning movement and sensations is different levels of subtlety. Particular contact and then sensation have different features for all of us. I was working with a chap in one of the introductory courses who said he didn't experience anything from the neck down in terms of the emotional dimension of his experience. And that was certainly an experience for me for many years. One of the earlier things we used to say when we were setting up for meditation was, looking at the emotional tone of your experience. And I had no idea what that meant, because I didn't have a direct experience of it. But it only became clear after going on retreat and meditating for a number of days, and suddenly it was like my internal world was waking up and was more alive. So sometimes it's just about the level of sensitivity that we're working with, rather than the fact that this experience isn't there. Yeah. So we all have the capability to engage with that experience, but it's sometimes the level of sensitivity that we have doesn't allow us to. And what we need to do is meditate more intensively, perhaps in the context of a retreat, for that experience, that vividness of experience, to open up a bit more. Does that make sense? So, does that make sense to everybody? Yeah. Okay. So in shamatha practice, we are laying down the foundations for a stability of mind, a stable mind, a mind that can stay with the object of concentration, whether that's the breath or whether it's the person. It's the ability to stay with that person and have a continuity of awareness that allows us to be with that experience over time. Okay. So in order to develop that, we need interest. We need interest in experience. We firstly need interest. We need to cultivate that sense of interest. And some of those questions I was suggesting are ways into interest. So, for example, the ways of engaging with experience, say, is the breath long or short? Is it broad or narrow? Is it rough or smooth? They're ways of accessing interest in the experience. Anybody who's done an introductory course will have heard the experience of the unfortunate Zen disciple who wasn't interested in the breath. The master puts his head underwater, yes, until he's struggling, and then lets him up and says, "How interested in the breath are you now?" Okay. So it's important. In a way that we realise that if we don't have interest, then absorption is not going to follow. So finding ways that allow us to be more interested in our object of concentration is important to developing a steady awareness. Yeah? Does that make sense? Okay. Independence on interest arises absorption. So if we can become absorbed in the breath, if we become interested in it and we stay with it, it's more likely we're going to become absorbed in it. And the reason for that is because our energy follows our interest. Yeah? Our energy follows our interest. So it's almost like our mind is behind, our emotions then get behind our mind. And we find ourselves being led more and more into the qualities of the breath. And the ability to stay with it becomes more naturally self-sustaining. If we can have interest, we may become absorbed. But interest is the necessary condition for absorption in the object of meditative concentration. So following on from that, if we've got energy for what we're doing, then we're more likely to have commitment. So commitment is the next thing that follows on. And then as we start to calm down, as we have less sense desire or distractions or restlessness, anxiety, or tiredness, or mental sloth. As our energy starts to follow our interest, it's more likely that those grosser distractions will drop away. Okay. The grosser distractions of sense desire, of wanting to get into chatter, of wanting, what am I having for dinner? When's this going to ring the bell? That sort of chatter that we sort of get into meditation can start to fall away as energy follows interest and absorption can arise. And it's just the act of staying with and keeping coming back to the object and the sensations and movement of our breath, if it's the mindfulness of breathing or the person, that will lead us into this more concentrated, more absorbed state. Now, there are a number of superconscious states that can arise in dependence on becoming absorbed. They're called the dhyanas, Buddhist jargon number two. You could say they're refined states of mind that develop in the context of being able to be absorbed in the breath or the person. Yeah. And they naturally arise. We don't have to strive for them. We don't have to reach after them. In fact, they'll never arise if we reach after them. They arise on the basis of the hindrances, sloth and torpor, sense desire, restlessness, doubt, and lack of commitment. They arise in the independence on those gross hindrances falling away. I'm going to invite you to do your own discoveries about them, because really they're only going to arise if we're in the context of intensive meditation on retreat. Reason to go on retreat number two, apart from Maitreya Bandhu's announcements about getting a more vivid life, but they're ever increasingly refined and absorbed mental states that can arise in dependence on absorption and interest. But I'd like to sort of step back from that. I'll invite you to read them, about them. They're in Vision and Transformation, The Noble Eightfold Path, in the section on Perfect Awareness, which is the part of The Noble Eightfold Path that precedes Perfect Samadhi, Perfect Concentration. They're also in Carmela Sheela's meditation book. But I'd invite you to go on a long retreat and experience them for yourself. In dependence on continuity of awareness, absorption, and intensity. Okay? Because those are the conditions for them to arise. And I'd like to step back from those states and to an intermediate state, really, which is called samapati. So we might have established a sense of absorption, a sense of the chatter of our mind just falls away. The chatter of our mind just falls away. It's almost like somebody turns the volume down in our mind. And we might just be accessing a little bit of absorption, yes? So this is there's a sort of a threshold of something arising. And you might notice that there is a sense of warmth, a sense of expansion, a sense of quietening of the mind. You might notice a nimbleness of mind, a clarity entering into our perception of what's happening in our experience. You might notice, a sense of peace, just a quietening down. And this is a particular quality. You could say that they're meditative qualities. Okay, they're also called samapatis. Samapati means attainment, but attainment's a really bad translation. It's a really unfortunate translation. Because you can't hold on to them, nor can, you know, and they only arise temporarily. And they arise in dependence on our mind refining itself through becoming absorbed in the object, like the breath. Yes? Are you with me? So, however, it's important that we know the potential is there. We might notice that, depending on our temperament, it may be the case that they arise in different ways for different people. So, for example, we might find ourselves quietening down and we might get a sense of light or white light in the mind. So you can sit there and you think, oh, who's turned the lights up? And you sort of open your eyes and the light in the room hasn't changed. But you can, and it's a quality of the mind refining that produces natural, spontaneous visual effects. You might hear a sort of rhythmic hum, a deep rhythmic hum. You might even hear things breaking, voices breaking through from the unconscious. You might get a sense of sense spontaneously arising. You might even have visionary experiences, landscapes or vivid pictures in the mind. You might have sensation experiences. You might feel immensely heavy and rooted. Or you could feel as light, like you could just blow away like thistle down on the wind. The thing to say that's important about this is nobody will experience the same ones. It's not necessary to experience them at all. But they're just clues to the mind becoming more refined, to the mind quietening down. And in a sense, if you notice this sense of warmth, the tendency to expand, the sense of uplift, the sense of something, a nimbleness of mind, it's important. It can even be accompanied by a sense of excitement, or we can get sort of excited about it, and we think something really significant is happening, and we can sort of grasp after it. We can say, "Oh, that's nice," and actually, it's the act of grasping that ends the experience. And I just wanted to make a point about working with these experiences when they arise. If they do, they're very subtle experiences, and all we need to do really is include them in experience. It's almost, we give them the amount of attention as if we're looking at them out of the corner of our eye. Yeah, we need give them no more attention than that, but we just include them, and they grow. And they lead us into more subtlety, more absorption in experience. So samapatis are clues that the mind is quietening down and refining. So let me stop there and see if there are any questions.
Nobody else.
Go on.
So, if you go on a retreat, you can, if you're lucky, have a wonderful experience. But are you saying that it's futile to try to get anywhere like that in your living room, meditating, fasting in the morning, or
it is
here once a week?
So the question is it only available on retreat?
Yeah, and if so, should one have different rejectors when one comes here, or one next time to meditate by oneself?
So there is the phenomena of beginner's mind. So when, even in a context of a meditation in a class, I've known people develop a sudden clarity about something that they've been thinking about prior to the class, but they have a level of understanding of it that they just didn't realise that they possessed prior to the meditative experience. So it can arise, even in the samapatti, a certain clarity or subtleness in experience can arise very spontaneously in the context of a single meditation practice. But I think it's important not to give them more significance than they actually indicate. They only indicate the mind is becoming more refined. In a sense, we can see them as clues, yeah? And give them no more significance than that. But if we include them, if we just give a certain attention, not grasp after them, they can lead us into greater subtlety. Do you see what I mean? Does that make sense?
So, I mean, is subtlety something that you come by if you're lucky, or is subtlety something that you can work at? I mean, would that be one reason for meditating every day?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. A daily meditation practice can certainly help us develop a more sensitive and supple mind. That's really the benefit of meditating. One of the benefits.
You've covered part of what I was going to say about home meditation. It's not just necessarily a matter of doing it every day. It's a matter of doing it at the same time every day, having a routine. It's part of your life, basically, rather than thinking, oh, after I come back from Tesco, I'll do it then type of thing. As far as I'm concerned, it's the first thing I do after I've had a cup of tea in the morning, and that can be 6 o'clock in the morning, it may be 7 o'clock, it depends, basically. And I always find that by adopting this routine, I stand a far better chance with my meditation. I had beginner's mind when I first started meditation, but that's a long time ago. And, you know, you have troughs of bad periods of meditation, but as far as I'm concerned, I still do it every morning and sit it out, basically. Whether I feel that I've got nowhere, and I don't even look at it from that point of view anymore. So I would say a regular routine. Just like going to work, starting work at 8, you do your routine at an earlier time before you go to work. If you leave it till night, you're too tired to do it.
So there's two important points there, is that it's important to have a regular practice if we want to see the benefits. However, it's also important just to turn up. You've just got to turn up. And mindful of the two earlier points about letting go of particular expectations of the practice, but just staying with a sense of the whatever arising and developing in the practice. I think it's really helpful to have a regular time slot. It's important to look after the conditions, particularly important to notice what we're doing before we meditate. You know, it's not just one more episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and then I'll meditate, or whatever. You know, whatever we're doing immediately before we meditate, we're taking into the meditation, we're taking that quality of mind into the meditation with us. And in a way, it serves as the conditions for where we're starting from. So it's important that we create some space around the meditation for calming down, or at least do something prior to the meditation which is consistent and going to help us lead us into the quality of mind that we hope to cultivate. So yes, it's important to have a regular practice and look after the conditions around meditative practice. So so that's the sort of second thing around meditative absorption. So how do we work with the refining mind? You know, some clues to the mind refining, these samapatis. We might notice they're calming down. And if we can turn towards them without a sense of grasping, and that's a practice, actually, that's a real practice. And the first few times it happens that we notice these things arising, they can have a sense of significance to them, and we can get kind of excited and grasp after them. But if we can learn to just sit back to acknowledge them, acknowledge that sense of refinement, that warmth. If we just invite it to be in experience without a sense of grasping, it will grow and it will lead us into greater subtlety in experience in our meditative practice. It will lead us into greater absorption.
I've just got a question. Is it sometimes when you're meditating you can get an insight into something? Which is quite helpful. Would that be one of those samapatis where...
So that might be a reflection of clarity of mind, yeah? So something that arises, a sort of knowledge that arose that was spontaneous, that we didn't have that perspective previously in relation to something. It can be a reflection of clarity. The question then is, what do we do with that? Do we, you know, because it can have this sense of excitement and energy with it. We have to make a decision then. I put this aside and I continue with the practice, or I get involved in the thinking. Either way, I'd suggest it's a choice that we make actively. So we make the choice mindfully, rather than just sort of bounce out into distraction. So at that point, if something's happening like that, we can either decide to, okay, that's interesting, important, I'll come back to that after I've meditated and come back to the practice, or we can just do some reflection on it. The choice is ours. I just invite you to play with it and just really explore things like that when they happen. Yeah. So as we develop our ability to stay with our experience, I'm going to come on to the final part of tonight, which is making where meditation meets reality. Because what we've done so far is we've looked at how we calm down, how we become absorbed, and what might be the indicators of a greater level of absorption or refinement of mind. And then, in dependence on that, we may find that our ability to stay with the breath is much more steady, much more. The gross distractions have fallen away. The volume's turned down. We might occasionally get the odd stray thought. You know, it's the flotsam and jetsam of consciousness, where something bubbles across the mind. But it has no emotional pull. We can just let it go. At some points, we can just notice even the tendency to start thinking and just let it go, because we're just so absorbed and with the breath or the person. And if we notice that stability is there, if we've become absorbed and we're concentrated, we can then start to introduce a particular contemplation. We can introduce a contemplation on impermanence, for example, or we can introduce a contemplation on insubstantiality. Now, I say a contemplation as opposed to a reflection. Okay? So, in the three levels of wisdom associated with the Dharma, Buddhist practice, we're here listening. Okay? That's the first level of wisdom. And we're here listening and learning about stuff. Then we might decide to reflect on it. We take it away, we turn it over in our minds, and we try and see the relevance in our lives, or we try and see the principles, say impermanence, more fully in our lives. Okay? And then the last level of wisdom, in a sense, or the most subtle form of wisdom, is meditating, or you could say contemplating. So the difference between reflection, which is an active thinking through, and contemplation, which is a direct seeing in our experience of that principle at work. Yeah. So just before the meditation this evening, I just invited you to notice the arising and passing of the breath. In a sense, I was inviting you to engage with a reflection initially, but also a contemplation of impermanence. So we see the arising and ceasing of the breath, directly experienced, physically felt, staying with that movement. Yeah. So we contemplate impermanence, a direct seeing of the principle in our body, in our experience. Yeah? So it's in this way that we contemplate impermanence in a meditative context. And we might, and certainly if we do any longer, or if we do any of the intensive meditation retreats, these types of contemplations will naturally be introduced. So we can take those contemplations when we experience our mind to be still, absorbed, free of distraction. We can just turn the mind towards, or orientate the mind towards, the arising and ceasing of the breath. And it may be the case that something responds. It may be that we light up with an understanding of impermanence that's not happened before. A sense of significance, a sense of truth in it that we've not seen or thought of. It's more of the nature of a realization. It's almost like our whole being can light up with a moment of realization that resonates with how things are. In a sense, we could have a moment of insight. It's almost like the whole being responds to that truth very, very directly, very, very essentially. And the quality of it is of wonder, of mystery. In a sense, we don't really understand what's happened. We thought we had an angle on impermanence. We thought we understood it. Well, we understood it cognitively, but we didn't understand it with our entire being. We didn't understand it in our emotional depths. But when the mind is still and we contemplate impermanence, sometimes our whole being understands it, responds to it, resonates with it. And this is the samadhi of the whole being. This is the samadhi of insight, you could say, meditative insight. I'm not going to go into any more jargon. I think I'm going to leave it there. There are many gateways to liberation, but I think impermanence is the most helpful one. If we want to cultivate a sense of a direct experience of our whole being, of the truth of impermanence, then that is one of the ways of doing it. It may be that we introduce that reflection, that contemplation, sorry, I'm mixing my terminology, that contemplation, and nothing happens. What we're doing then is we're creating the conditions. We're just creating the conditions for our being to respond to that truth. And it might be we walk out of the shrine room and a leaf falls from the tree. And it stops us. It stops us in our tracks. And it's accompanied by a release of energy and a quality of realization. So we don't know when moments of insight into reality will arise. All we can do is create the conditions for them through cultivating a stability of mind through meditative absorption, noticing the qualities of the refining mind, engaging with them creatively, and then when the mind is still, turning our mind to a direct contemplation of the principle of impermanence. And in that way, we will, over time, orientate our mind to that truth. And it becomes a more essential truth, felt and seen more deeply, that eventually lights up our whole being with understanding. An understanding that's without words. An understanding that's full of wonder and mystery. That isn't just cognitive, but it's a knowing with the whole being. So I'm going to stop there and see if there are any final questions, or maybe we just leave it there actually. Leave it in the wondrous silence. Okay, let's start.
Thank you.